From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Hi, this is Wax Paper. This is Lauren.
Hi, Lauren. I'd like to order a sandwich to go, please.
For sure. What can I get for you?
Could I get the Evan Kleiman, please?
Evan was a special we did a couple Thursdays ago. It was just a special we did for the day.
Oh, okay. I thought I was evergreen. I didn't think I ever went out of season. So I guess I'll have the Ira glass.
You got it. Is this Evan?
Yes, it is.
How are you, my dear?
I'm good.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, we do specials every Thursday, so we had you on then, and I'm sure we can have you back again someday. But yeah.
It's okay. Actually, this is a fake call. We're doing a sandwich show this Saturday.
Oh, awesome.
So we're starting the show with this call on tape.
Oh my gosh, how funny.
Thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, you're welcome. Did you really want a sandwich or is the
call? No. Okay. I'm in Santa awesome. Monica.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Yep. This week on the show, we are all about sandwiches. We first ran this show back in October, but who doesn't love a repeat sandwich? Let's kick it off with the vehicle that holds them together, bread.
You know, you can find whole grain bread, but nobody's really growing heritage grains the way we are right now.
That's Charles Dedlow, one of the owners of Rowan Mills. Laura Avery caught up with him at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
You look at the ingredients list on bread in the store, and it's like whole paragraph long. Literally, the only thing in our bread is just flour, water, and salt.
Charles, you know about the process of growing and harvesting the grain. Can you just tell us what kind of grain you're growing?
So basically, we're growing three main varieties of heritage grains. We got the Sonora, the Glen, and the Red Fife, all of which we're harvesting a new crop of right now. And then basically we take that and mill it into flour and then bake it into our fresh bread every day for the farmer's market.
Charles, can you kind of describe what the process is from when you first start a loaf to when it comes out of the oven?
What our bakery team does is the day before, they have a night, actually, a whole night of, shaping and getting all the bread ready and put in little containers. And once it's all shaped, then we put towels over it and it sits for 24 hours and that's when it starts to rise. And then they come in the next day at 12 o'clock or like 11:30 at night, and then they'll bake actually till 4 o'clock in the morning when, our driver comes and picks it up. For example, the Wednesday market today, they were baking all night long. And then that bread's totally fresh and, we come up to the market and it's still totally warm. So it's a two-day process. The first day is mainly the shaping and the rising, which is just it sitting there. And then the second day is all the baking.
And is it a sourdough or do you add yeast?
We do not add any yeast. It's a sourdough starter. So the whole idea behind that is it's just flour and water that ferments. And sort of like a mother for kombucha, it keeps that going. And then every day we feed that. And then when we do our big bakes, we take some of that. And that's what is actually like the basis for all the dough, for all the bread.
Yeah. And a lot of people think that, whole grain bread, it's going to be heavy like a brick. And your bread is light and delicious. It's got a fine grain. Is that a product of just your technique?
It's partly that, but it's also partly the sourdough starter. It's such a great way, and it's like the original way to really, bake bread, and it's the most natural way, so it really creates a lot of natural yeast in there, and natural, like, enzymes and everything just really makes the bread rise really rapidly. That, mixed with our very fresh grains that we're using, just creates a really nice, soft, but totally whole grainy and, simply done loaf.
Do you have to knead it or put it in a mixer?
Well, yeah, that falls into part of the first day. They take the dough that they've created with the sourdough starter, huge thing of dough, and then they start kneading it and shaping it. And shaping it is like an art on its own, because to get a perfect loaf that doesn't have air bubbles that are too big and big air pockets in there has to be shaped correctly. And if you don't do that, it'll actually, bake, and then you'll cut it open and it'll be like hollow on the inside or have a really large air pocket, which, isn't ideal. So the shaping process is very important to the bread's outcome. So that takes a long time, and they do shape it and then let it sit. And then right the next day when they pop it into the oven, they cook it for like a little bit and then they pull it out and slice the top of it. And that's how we get those big, nice designs on our crust. And that kind of opens it up, lets it get some air in there, makes for the perfect crust.
So sourdough bread doesn't have to be sour.
does not have to be sour. And if you come and try our bread, like the Red Fife Glambool, that one is a really whole grainy flavor, and you actually don't really taste the sourdough too much just because of how rich and intense the flavor of the actual grain in that one is. But then, that said, if you try like something like our Sonora loaf, it's going to be a much lighter, more sourdough tasting one. It doesn't have that intense whole grainy flavor coming through, but it has a lot more of the sourdough flavor coming through. But the cool thing about all of our bread is that like those two have the same amount of whole grain content. So, you know, that's why people like our bread so much, is because, you know, you don't have to get the really dark, heavy loaf for it to be whole grain, you know?
Is it easier to digest?
It is, yeah. A lot of it is all the heritage grains are naturally lower in gluten. The Sonora is actually the lowest in gluten, and we have people coming by the farmer's market who just, you know, the bread catches their eye, and they're, I can't eat bread, I'm gluten intolerant. And then we get them to try our Sonora loaf, and they have no problem digesting, and they come back every week. And I can't tell you how many times people have just been, like, you know, mind blown that they can digest this bread totally fine. That's part of going back to that it's just freshly milled, freshly baked, you know. A lot of the stuff you get in the store is not going to be like that. And that's why people have this whole thing associated with bread. You know, they're not thinking of original bread. And that's what we're baking, you know. And so, we're really doing it the old school way.
So little kids can get your loaf of Red Fife, make a PB&J, and eat the whole thing and not freak out because it's not white bread.
Yeah, and we also even have a lighter sandwich loaf. It's a Sonora sandwich loaf. And, yeah, I mean, we have parents coming by all the time, and they've gotten their kids hooked on it, and they make them, you know, French toast with it, everything. So kids like it, adults like it. Everyone's going for the bread.
How many loaves do you bake at one time?
It depends. On Wednesdays, for example, we're baking around 300 loaves, 250 to 300. And then we also do some weekend farmers markets in Hollywood and Atwater, and that's about another 250 loaves, so...
Which one has the most intense flavor?
I would say the one that has the most intense flavor is probably the Red Fife Glambool. So the Red Fife wheat's like a very dark, whole grainy variety. And that particular loaf just has a lot of whole grain flavor, and it's very high in protein.
Yeah, and I know that when I get your the big boule, I just get it home, and within a day or two, I'll slice it and then freeze it.
Yeah.
And just pull them out and toast them as I go.
As far as it goes for, like, keeping the bread, we recommend keeping it wrapped up in our wax paper bags. And the great thing about how fresh our bread is it'll actually last for a whole week. So, you know, I'll take bread home, and as long as you keep it wrapped up in the bag and not in plastic, it'll stay good for about 7 days.
Yeah, but I go through it pretty fast.
Yeah. It'll never last 7 days in my house, but...
I don't think a baguette has ever lasted longer than a day.
Yeah, or just a drive back to your house.
Right. How do you enjoy the bread most?
So my personal favorite is our Sonora Country Blonde. And what I like to do with that one is I'll take two nice thick slices of that and actually put it on the grill and grill it. And then rub it with garlic, and then you have a couple pieces of that. You can put some, like, burrata, some salami, some basil maybe, and you can just make these simple, delicious sandwiches. And they're really filling because the bread has a lot of protein in them. And then you're just set. And obviously, if you can't grill it, totally fine to put it in your oven or, like, in your toaster, rather, and toast it up. And then, yeah, rubbing it with garlic is, like, my favorite thing to do. Makes for a good basis for any sandwich.
All right, Charles, thanks so much.
Thanks.
That was Charles Dedlow. He's a family member and co-owner of Roan Mills, Kenter Canyon. You can find the bread at the Wednesday Santa Monica, the Sunday Hollywood Market. But pretty soon there will be more outlets for that bread around farmers markets and other places. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Next, we get a little history lesson into how the sandwich evolved in the UK. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. If you watch British television and you're food-obsessed, before too long you start seeing the sandwiches. Always plain, wrapped in paper or prepackaged, but simple, unlike ours, which are often towering Dagwood inspirations. Our man to talk Brit Sarnies, as he calls them, is noted magazine editor John Haney. He's worked at Savour and Gourmet, now he's at Tatler. So we've all heard about the Earl of Sandwich and his card game, but I'm curious how the British sandwich evolved. Did it start with the Earl?
Yes, pretty much, as far as I know. And it wasn't long after the Earl was alive that I appeared on the scene. And my earliest memories of sandwiches go back to the 1950s. not long after rationing finished, and it wasn't often a pretty sight, but I enjoyed them.
Describe sort of the Ur Brit sandwich, the one that people eat most often.
Once again, I'm going back to my childhood, and sort of comfort food, it tends to live with you. And now that I'm, well, shall we say, over 50, I'm kind of reacquainting myself with the sandwiches that kept me going when I was younger. Going back to basics, of course, there's an amazing Mrs. Beaton basic called the toast sandwich, and that was two slices of white bread surrounding one piece of toast. Apparently, it costs about 7.5p to make, and it was eaten. I think if it hadn't been, it wouldn't have been in her cookbook.
Do you think any millennials today have eaten a toast sandwich?
I expect foodie millennials have, because if they've read Mrs. Beaton, one would want to experiment, even if only once.
I mean, it is the ultimate in frugality.
It's well down there, yes. Next stop, nothing. But the really basic stuff I started on was sugar sandwiches. When I was very young, because when I was born, rationing was just about to end after World War II, and everybody was finally getting all the sugar they wanted. That was considered a sandwich, as was a syrup sandwich, and it was that simple. It was two bits of butter bread with some syrup in the middle. There's the fried egg sandwich, just a fried egg in a sandwich. Once again, it's a very simple formula. Banana sandwich. Always a pleasure. Chocolate spread on two pieces of bread. That was a precursor to a good old Nutella. Then we have horror stories like the condensed milk sandwich. Such a thing does exist. I've not had one for a very long time, but I know I enjoyed them. Things like bread and dripping, which is just sort of beef dripping from cooking beef. You get a bit of juice and a lot of very salty something, which is spreadable. Very high protein. It was poverty food. It was Great Depression food and wartime food. I've not been offered that in a long time, but if someone did offer me some, I would definitely eat it.
And talk to me about this name, a sarnie.
I think it began to come into vogue in Britain in the 70s. I hadn't heard it at home, and then I went to college and moved to London, and all of a sudden I'm hearing the word sarnie, and I think the first time I heard it, I figured, okay, it's a sandwich, but it's news to me. And that's how they're commonly referred. Well, not so commonly referred to now, but 70s, 80s, that might have been its heyday.
One of the things that you hear all the time when you're watching television are cheese sandwiches and cheese and pickle sandwiches.
Oh, yes.
What does a cheese sandwich consist of?
It would depend when you were eating it. When I was growing up, it was elementary. Once again, it was two bits of white bread. Buttered or slapped with margarine, and one very thin slice of very ordinary cheese, particularly in cafes. Back in those days, cafe sandwiches were really, really sketchy. But it was considered worth eating, and that was what my father took to work every day of his life for as long as I can recall. Basic cheese sandwiches, yeah. Nowadays, of course, you've got all these choices of cheese and the most remarkable bread. And so it's evolved into a complete meal. And being a bit of a cheese fanatic, I've been known to put a medium brie just in the middle of a baguette, and in I go, basically.
Do you think that the cheese sandwich is related at all to the ploughman's lunch?
I think the ploughman's lunch has been revealed as something of a pub gimmick. I remember it coming along in the 70s and early 80s, and the first question that my friends and I tended to ask was, well, you know, who is this mythical ploughman? We had the impression that it was just an addition to the menu. It was perfectly pleasant, but it wasn't about going back to some kind of rural idyll.
Could you describe it?
Yeah. The bread it came with was a good deal crusty on the Wonder Loaf. It would be three or four chunks of cheese, quite roughly cut, with a slice or two of tomato and maybe a piece of lettuce on a plate. I mean, the presentation wasn't bad by pub standards, but it was nothing sophisticated. And I think for a while it was very popular.
Okay, and what about the pickle? When someone says, I'm having a cheese and pickle sandwich, it's not like pickles like we think of pickles, right?
Oh, no, nothing to do with half sours, no. The pickle came in jars. It was very spicy and fairly crunchy. And you would just simply put, once again, a slice of cheese on some white bread, top that with some pickle, more bread on top, and that was your cheese and pickle sandwich. Very popular in pubs and at home. Yes, it was a very quick meal. I had one this morning, actually, so it's still around.
Now, how did prawns manage to get into the mix? When I hear the words, I'll have a prawn sandwich, something in me just shivers.
Yes, the prawn sandwiches came along quite a bit later. A prawn sandwich is fairly straightforward. You get some supermarket prawns and just hack them up and then put them between two pieces of bread. But it was very much preceded by something called the fish paste sandwich. I've forgotten if you can get fish paste in the States, but you can still get it here. It is what it is. It's simply fish reduced to paste. Once again, you spread it on two pieces of bread and it's called a sandwich.
What is astounding to me is the lack of condiment on many of these sandwiches.
Yes, well, of course, the pickle, once upon a time, was, it was almost the condiment. We've always been a bit leery of condiments. And of course, they're catching on like crazy now, but it was very different 50 years ago.
So when you talk about two pieces of bread with something between, like the prawns, would there be a slather of mayonnaise?
Yes, I think so. Maybe not so much at the beginning. I know that, you know, I've had prawn sandwiches that contained simply butter and chopped prawns. Although potted shrimp was also a popular addition, and that was considered rather classy, actually.
Describe what potted shrimp is.
Okay, it's chopped up bits of shrimp, comes in a small jar, in a kind of mayonnaise. It has a rather buttery texture. It wasn't as cheap as fish paste, and it was almost considered high class in, shall we say, working class families. It was like, ooh, you know, that's classy.
What is the role of the sandwich in a day of eating? What time of day is it usually eaten?
I think it's very much a lunchtime thing in terms of going to the office. So sandwich shops are, of course, doing a roaring trade in London. And what you can get now at companies like Pret a Manger, who do have their critics, well, frankly, do stop complaining, because 40 years ago, your basic lunchtime sandwich was, once again, two bits of butter. A beef sandwich would contain one shred of beef, and that would be your sandwich. Nowadays, of course, you can barely hold them. Still not as big as American sandwiches, which I do miss, but they're substantial.
And is a prepackaged sandwich necessarily inferior to a freshly made one?
No, I really don't think it is. I don't have shares in Pret a Manger, but their sandwiches are made on the spot, and they do taste rather fresh.
Breakfast sandwiches, are they as popular there as they are here?
In terms of things like toasters that you can just fling into the toaster, I wouldn't say they're that popular. Toast remains very popular, and sometimes that can be breakfast. Yeah.
And by toast, do you mean simply a piece of sliced bread toasted?
With some butter, yes. It's as simple as that. Although, more commonly in Britain, of course, we add Marmite, which is the awful yeast extract that Americans tend not to like. My friends in New York certainly didn't. They tried it once, and that was the end of it.
And I understand it's the first product that seems to be affected by Brexit.
Yes, yes. I think that dispute has been settled, much to our relief. But frankly, it's so ingrained in our sort of food traditions that I'm not saying we'd pay anything for it. But, 25% increase? I think they still sell plenty of it here.
So let's talk about the bread, because the bread's so important. Mm. For most sandwiches that people eat, are we talking about a loaf?
It depends what you're after. There's still a lot of supermarket bread eaten here, and I'm as guilty as the next person. But the breads are becoming much more important, and there's a much greater range. And so, of course, if you've got the time and a sufficiently educated taste, you really can turn a sandwich into a meal, and you would start with getting yourself some really good bread. And that isn't in short supply here. Artisanal bakers are springing up absolutely everywhere, and they're doing a great job.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to muse on about sandwiches that I haven't asked you?
I think the sheer simplicity of the sandwiches that I grew up with, and they're still being eaten. Yes, it's a subject close to my heart, the sandwich, I must admit.
John Haney is the author of the book Fair Shares for All, a memoir of family and food. Now we return to our side of the pond to talk with the author of the book, a super upsetting book about sandwiches. That would be Tyler Cord. He's the chef owner of the number 7 restaurant and sub shops in New York. Hi, Tyler.
Hi.
One of the sandwiches in your book, the most written about, I'm sure, is the broccoli classic. It's roasted broccoli, lychee muchim, feta, fried shallots, pine nuts, and mayo. And at your number 7 sub shop, you can get it as a sandwich or a bowl. And there's a version at your number 7 restaurant in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, too, except it's the double-decker taco version.
Sure.
Talk about the origin of the components of the sandwich.
Sure, although I don't know if it's going to be a very satisfying story. You know, I started with broccoli and I wanted to make a broccoli sandwich, and each ingredient kind of just brought me to the next one. So I wanted to do roasted broccoli, and then it wanted something kind of tart and sweet. And so the lychees are sweet, and then when they're pickled, they're obviously tart. So that seemed like the appropriate thing to do. That tipped it a little too sweet and bright, and so the briny cheese kind of brings it back into a salty place, and then the fried shallots and pine nuts just make everything taste delicious.
And of course, there's mayo.
And mayo is, you know, it's a sandwich, so there's mayonnaise on it. There's not mayo on all the sandwiches, but I like mayonnaise on sandwiches. Especially back when I invented that one, I was putting mayonnaise on just about everything.
So tell us what mucheem is and the role of it in your sandwiches.
Sure. I'm using that word in a really loose, weird way. It's a Korean word that basically means like mixed or salad, to the best of my understanding. But it is generally used to describe oimuchim, which is basically like a cucumber salad. And it kind of tastes like a non-fermented kimchi, if you will. So it's spicy and it's, you know, a tiny bit sweet and it's bright and awesome. So we started out at the sandwich shop using it to make our like pickles, like because we're a New York City sandwich shop. So we needed to have a pickle, but I wanted to do something interesting. So I took this brine, this kind of Korean cucumber brine, and just brined whole Kirby cucumbers in it. And then that kind of led itself to, it turned out that brine was just good on everything. So, you know, we ended up brining kind of just anything you can think of in it. But the lychee version is probably my favorite.
Another thing that isn't the mucheem but is salad-y, pico de lettuce.
Yeah, that one was just straight marketing.
So what is pico de lettuce?
Honestly, it's just a salad that has just been sitting there for too long.
You know, that's one of my favorite things.
Yeah, it's totally awesome.
It is. Whenever I have people over and there's leftover salad, my favorite thing is to eat it the next morning for breakfast.
I grew up, my mom made a salad for most family dinners at home, and she would make it, and then we would generally wait and eat it after dinner, at which point it was pretty, like, soggy. It is, like, condensed salad. It's all the flavor of that salad minus a lot of the water. So I didn't know what to call it. And I had a moment of brilliance, or I don't know, or I was just drunk, but it just occurred to me one night. I was like, what if we call it pico de lettuce? And then it's like, it's not salad. It's this like pickled thing. I don't know. And then my wife thought I was crazy, but I put it on the menu and like nobody really reacted to it, which seemed like it wasn't a good or bad thing. I guess it seemed like a good thing because people weren't like, what the hell is that? They just kind of were like, yeah, it's got pico de lettuce on it. Great. I'll eat that. And I just love it.
Let's talk about veggie burgers. Describe what you mean by fake meaty.
Sure. The veggie burgers that are kind of fake meaty are the ones that are, you know, they're the ones that are trying the hardest to be meat. They're like the Boca burgers and those like Dr. Prager's ones and stuff. And they're delicious. I actually really like those. And actually in the fake meat category, I just the other day had that Beyond Meat, the veggie burger that bleeds. It was pretty awesome. So anyway, I do enjoy the fake meat. I feel like a lot of people have attitude about the idea, well, oh, you're vegetarian, so why are you trying to eat this thing that tastes like meat? And it, like, for some reason, it seems to offend people and rub them the wrong way. But if you've ever been vegetarian, and it, like, as somebody who eats meat, and then if you try not to eat meat, having eaten it your whole life, if you try not to eat it for a few weeks, like, something feels totally missing from your meals at some point. And like, I don't know. I went through it too. We had customers at one point we had the seitan sandwich that I took off the menu. And we had these customers that were like, come on, what are you talking about? You got rid of that. And I was like, well, don't worry. We still have a broccoli sandwich and a cauliflower sandwich. And they were like, all I eat are vegetables. Like, I want something meaty. Anyway, so that's what those burgers are there for. And they are great. And I love them. And they totally work for that. Though, I don't necessarily think it's the best way to go about it.
And then you also have an opinion about the ones that are super vegetable-y.
Well, that's kind of the other end of the spectrum too, right? And especially when they get really grainy. Because at some point you're like, well, I'm eating a sandwich that is like a starch inside of two pieces of starch with like some ketchup on it. And that doesn't feel like a thing that I need to be doing. That said, there's nothing wrong with it. I love a samosa just like anybody does. But like, when you're eating a burger, you know, you don't necessarily want like a bunch of grains in your bread. That just seems weird.
What was your happy medium?
what I found for that kind of in-between thing is we mix equal parts of seitan that we've, you know, which is wheat protein, which we grind in a food processor, a meat grinder, and then we mix it that with equal parts broccoli, and then we just bind it with a little cornstarch and water. We were using eggs, but it turned out that the cornstarch worked just fine, and so that way it's vegan, which is fun. Then everybody can eat it.
Speaking of cornstarch, you use it in a lot of recipes. Could you explain what it does for you?
So in the case of the burger, it, you know, it just holds it together so that it's not just a crumbly mess. In general, cornstarch, I mean, it's, you know, it thickens things, which maybe that's the chef in me, but I don't like a sauce to be literally the texture of water. I tend to, you know, want things to have a little more staying power than that. So I tend to thicken them a tiny bit.
I'm sure the cornstarch in that burger must also give it a nice crispness when you sear it.
It does, yeah. So the outside gets nice and crunchy. It's awesome.
You have a deep relationship with broccoli, and I'm wondering why.
I don't know. I mean, like, who can just explain love? I'm not a poet, and I'm not a a chemist, but I don't know. It's delicious. It's my favorite thing to eat.
Really? It's your absolutely favorite thing to eat?
I mean, it depends on the day, I suppose, but, like, generally speaking, it's the thing that I want to eat more than anything else.
I wonder if that's because you live in New York and for a lot of the year it's the only vegetable you can get.
Well, I mean, it's a short growing season here on the East Coast, so most of the broccoli that we eat out here comes from California, but there's always broccoli at the grocery store. There's not always broccoli at the green market, but sometimes there is.
Okay, so I have to ask you where you stand on the hot dog burrito sandwich debate.
Meaning, is a hot dog a sandwich and is a burrito a sandwich?
Yes.
I mean, I obviously love sandwiches, so I'm pretty inclusive. Also, I find, like, those kinds of food debates kind of weird, because does it really matter? I'm probably offending lots of people right now, aren't I? But I tend to include all things in the sandwich category. I can make anything a sandwich if I want it to be. But I guess I also just am very confident.
So on that making anything a sandwich thing, I have to read you an Eddie Wong quote.
Okay.
He said about your cookbook, quote, "I've always said that if you want white people to understand your culture, you should put it on bread. In the tradition of pairing the other with simple carbohydrates, Tyler Cord has written a book about sandwiches so that finally white people may understand the culture of self-hating, neurotic New York chefs."
Yeah.
Isn't that the best quote ever?
It is the best quote. When he sent that to me, I sent it to my editor, and I was like, all right, guys, I got the quote from Eddie. Here it goes. And I was like, are they gonna print that on the back of my book? But they did. And they were actually really excited about it.
And what do you think of it?
What do I think of it? I mean, I don't think, I knew when I asked that there was no way that Eddie was going to write a quote for me that didn't make fun of me at least a little bit. No, I think I love it. I think it's great.
And I do really think it is true that people accept so much that they may be afraid of if it's between two pieces of bread.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. Although, that is something that is like, because it wasn't that long ago that people were like, a broccoli sandwich, what are you talking about? You know, but yeah, but I guess the idea of a sandwich has changed, and that's good. And maybe I helped with that.
We all need a mission.
We all need a mission and patient investors.
Yeah, that is so true. The sandwiches on your menu have great names. There's like Dan Smith Will Teach You Guitar, which is named after the Dan Smith guitar lesson flyers that are stuck on every telephone pole in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
How do you come up with the names?
Again, I drink a lot, and that makes me think I'm really funny, and then I come up with these clever things that I don't like. A lot of the ones in the cookbook, admittedly, like I was several of them. I've been interviewed a couple times with the book, and a couple people have been like, oh, how did you come up with the name for this one? And I'm like, I don't remember. Like, I know that it was something really clever, and I'd like did some research on like this one weird Herbie Hancock record, but I can't remember what that name was about. So I don't know. They all come from like weird, goofy trains of thinking, I suppose.
So the ice cream sandwich, do you consider it a sandwich, and do you have one at the shops?
The ice cream, no, we don't, because doesn't that seem like maybe too much sandwich? Like to eat a sandwich and then have an ice cream sandwich? We talked about it.
Oh, well, I think you need to do it. You know, the Neapolitans serve ice cream in a warm brioche.
Yeah, and that sounds awesome. I'm not opposed to it, but no, we have never served one.
Well, I hope you think about it.
I will.
But the one thing that you do a lot that we all do at home and are sometimes ashamed to admit it is we put potato chips or corn chips in our sandwiches.
Right, but that's just awesome. I don't know why anybody would be ashamed of that. before we opened the sandwich shop, I was like, we should open a sandwich shop and we should put potato chips on all the sandwiches. And that just seemed like a really good idea.
And are they on? They're not on all the sandwiches.
No, they're not. But they've always been on a couple of them. And people like that.
William Wegman.
Yeah.
So he did the drawings or the photographs?
He just did the like 10 or so drawings that open each chapter.
They're so fantastic.
He took old cookbooks, you know, he'd cut an image out of it, and then he would kind of extrapolate from there.
Are the dogs part of your customer base?
I mean, I assume that the dogs were sitting next to him while he did those pieces. Their spirit is in there. But I don't think they've ever eaten one of my sandwiches.
Well, thank you so much. You know, it's a hilarious book, but it's not a gimmicky book.
Thank you. I did my best. I wanted it to be funny, but I wanted it to be useful, and I just wanted it to be the best thing that I could make, and that was different from the other things out there.
I'm definitely going to plunder the condiments in the book.
Good. Do. Yeah, and, you know, I wonder, because I feel like I've gotten a lot of questions about some of the, like, more difficult things since it came out, and I guess maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe I didn't do enough. Here's how you make roast beef and how you make mayonnaise and how you make this pickle. But, like, if you just do one of those three things and, like, buy the other stuff, you know, the book doesn't have to be that hard because you could just buy two out of every three ingredients and then assemble, you know, and just make one of the recipes and then make the sandwich.
But the thing is, once you have that condiment, you're going to find a million other ways to use it if it's sitting there in your refrigerator.
So, yes. So, please, make all the condiments.
Thank you very much, Tyler.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And again, thank you so much for having me and for liking the book. I appreciate it so much.
Tyler Cort's book is a super upsetting book about sandwiches. You can get his patty melt, well, not his patty melt exactly, but the recipe for his patty melt on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we continue our look at what's inside the sandwich with a certified pastrami doctor. We're not kidding. Don't turn that dial. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
I got greedy. I flew too close to the sun on wings of pastrami.
Yeah, that's what you did. I can't believe I got another session with Izzy Mandelbaum. He's probably going to make me box a kangaroo. What's going on?
I don't know. Sandwich is making me flush.
Oh, no. I'll tell you what you did, Caligula. You've combined food and sex into one disgusting, uncontrollable urge.
I think you're right. You going to eat that?
No, but please tell me that's all you're going to do with it.
Jerry. If this woman dies, it is going to be a major inconvenience.
These fries are really, really good.
All right, that's enough of that.
I mean, I can't shake this woman. You know, now I got to go to Jimmy's birthday party.
Whew. Sleepy.
We played that scene for you from Seinfeld because we're about to talk about that most iconic of sandwich meats, pastrami. The woman to cover this subject for us is Laura Rabinovich Newman. She's writing a book about pastrami and Little Romania in early 20th century New York City. And even better, Laura's actually a pastrami doctor. I love that you did your dissertation on pastrami. So I have to know, why did you choose that subject?
Well, I was interested in Romanian Jews. But I guess the inspiration was that most of my family is from Montreal in Canada. And smoked meat is a big part of the city. And it's sort of iconic in the city's culinary landscape as a whole. And I grew up with these stories of my Romanian Jewish ancestors and these smoky nights where there was a lot of dancing and music and delicious food. And smoked meat is part of that. And so I was really curious about who were these Romanian Jewish immigrants and what was their connection to food. And so it was Romanian Jews that brought pastrami to the New World. Basically, in a word, if I'm studying Romanian Jewish immigrants, I'm studying pastrami.
I love that. So how did pastrami end up in L.A.?
Basically, Jews from Romania came to the New World with pastrami. They came to L.A. at the turn of the 20th century and then in greater numbers between the wars. And they brought with them pastrami. But Boyle Heights was where they first settled. And that was probably where pastrami was first sold in some of the early delis, canters there. I'm not sure that we could definitively say that pastrami was first in Boyle Heights, but we can definitively say, I think, that pastrami comes to L.A. with Romanian Jewish immigrants.
So is there a pit stop in New York? Do these immigrants stop in New York, start doing businesses, and then some of them fling off farther west to L.A.? Or is this some immigrants go to New York, some immigrants come to L.A.?
Well, you have to remember at the time there were no airplanes, so you had to come to the New World via a port. And if you were coming from Eastern Europe, that meant that you probably stopped in New York along the way. Certainly, New York was the locus for Jewish immigrants at the turn of the 20th century and still is today. I would say the growth of pastrami is definitely much more widespread in New York City. However, it has remained a Jewish food in New York City. In L.A., you see a completely different story.
So before we get to that story, I understand that Romanian Turks used to carry cured meat under their saddles.
So because Romania was a colony of the Turkish Empire at the time, this is in the 19th and even in the late 18th century, roving Turkish army men used to come to their Balkan lands, including what is now known as Romania. In order to fortify their travels, they would travel with meat under their saddles that they were pressing. And pastirm means to press. So the idea of pastirm, or even the Turkish basturma, which you may also know as the salt-cured meat, the idea is to press the meat, and the salt is what's curing the meat and preserving it along the way. This is before the era of refrigeration. So saddles were what filled in for refrigeration and the modern day cooler.
No, but it makes so much sense because you're pressing it, you have the salt, so all the water that causes bacteria is getting out of the meat. What is pastrami? Is there a certain set of spices that are part of every pastrami?
There's probably a certain set, like coriander, garlic, sugar, certain vinegars, perhaps, that are in every spice mix and every brine that a pastrami goes through. But I would say every deli man probably keeps his spice mix very close to his heart. There's no one recipe for pastrami. There's no one method. But in general, it is a slow-cooked food. So it is usually the navel or the brisket of the cow. And originally, it was mutton or camel back in the Turkish saddle days. Or in the New World, originally, it was goose meat. It's only more recently, with the expansion of the cattle industry, that we see meat and beef. It is cured in a wet brine for up to even 2 weeks sometimes, if you're really doing it in the traditional way. Oftentimes, if it's done commercially, then that process can be sped up. And then after brining, it is smoked, which is why in some places like Montreal, it's called smoked meat. And then after smoking, it is steamed before serving and hand-sliced if done very traditionally.
Okay. I could say my favorite pastrami in town, Langer's, Wexler's. But the pastrami we're talking about today isn't that kind of pastrami. I know that on a really hot day, you and my producer, Abby, drove to Boyle Heights, and you ate three pastrami sandwiches, which I can't even fathom, at three different roadside taco and burger stands. I think when I was a child, I had a really bad experience with one of these kinds of pastrami sandwiches. It's so different. I've always considered it, something really out of left field. So where did you go, and what was the pastrami like?
We went to, and just to say, these are not necessarily the best pastrami burgers or pastrami sandwiches in Los Angeles or even necessarily in Boyle Heights, but they're sort of three iconic places. The thing that's so interesting is that you can get this kind of pastrami all over L.A., not just at a Jewish deli, which is unusual to anywhere else in the world. So we went in Boyle Heights. We went to Tom's Burgers, where we had a pastrami sandwich, and that's not related to the Tom's fast casual chain that's all over L.A., and it's also not related to the original Tommy's on Beverly. It's sort of its own thing. So we went to Tom's, and we went to Dino's Burgers, and we went to Jim's Burgers. So a lot of these are burger shacks. They're not necessarily taco stands. They're sort of hybrid burger taco stands. They're roadside stands more than anything that come in the post-war era. They're the, they have the googie architecture, that sort of vintage LA. The idea is that you can pull up really quickly or even go through a drive-thru, which is what we did for the third option, and get a pastrami sandwich or a pastrami burger even. And that is what we did. We got a pastrami sandwich at Tom's Burgers. The pastrami sandwich that you'll get in Boyle Heights and at many of these roadside stands is not the pastrami sandwich that you'll find on Rye. Instead, it's the Jewish version. In other words, the classic Jewish version. It is served on a French roll most frequently. It is not hand-sliced, so it is very thinly machine-sliced. And it has sometimes jalapeno within or pickles within the sandwich, chopped up, sort of bejeweled between the slices of meat.
And sometimes is the thinly sliced pastrami seared on a flat top?
Not that I've ever seen, but I should also say that in some places like Johnny's Pastrami, which is also, I think, part of this category of roadside pastrami, they will also serve it with its jus on the side, which is much more evocative of Cole's French dip or some of the other iconic LA French dip that we have. So you have a pastrami dip.
Let's hear some tape from your crawl.
So here we are in Boyle Heights, and we are at Tom's Burgers and Pastrami since 1956.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. What can I do for you?
We're going to have a pastrami sandwich, please. You have like taquitos, chili dogs, flautas, burgers, chili fries, and pastrami.
Yeah. Yeah, the pastrami is very popular.
I'm glad they have it.
You love?
I've been eating here for 40 years.
40 years you've been eating the pastrami here?
Since I was a kid. I'm 41. And I've been coming here since my mom was pregnant with me.
Wow.
We have customers from Tijuana. They came here to visit to Los Angeles, and they come specifically for pastramis. And we have one family. They come from Las Vegas. And they came on a big truck, and they came only for the pastramis. I think it's good.
So here we have these. I don't know what they are exactly, like banana peppers? But you have, like, this crusty French roll, which I don't know how that got into the mix. I guess someone probably couldn't get rye bread. Mustard. And sliced pickle.
All right, here we go. I just got to say, for the record, this is it's a big sandwich.
That is the only thing that I would say the Mexican pastrami shares with the more traditional Jewish pastrami sandwich is that it is stuffed. It's as much meat as you can fit between the two slices of bread. Even though we're not at Carnegie Deli, we sort of have Carnegie Deli proportions here in terms of meat to bread. And the meat itself is not bad.
Yeah, I think it's actually pretty good.
Okay, so we're at Dino Burgers, classic burger shack, established in 1968. Looks like not much has changed since then. And most importantly, it has like the window on the road eating. You know, that's what makes this such an interesting story, is that you're getting pastrami on the road. And this restaurant advertises its burritos, its burgers, and its pastrami on its marquee outside the restaurant. So where else in the world do you get pastrami and burritos on the same restaurant marquee on a major city thoroughfare? And then inside, not only do you have the sort of aquamarine banquettes, but you have a bucket of jalapenos pickled ready to go with anything you order.
I'm Nick Fernandez. I've been working here at Dino's Burgers for about 2 years. So we have a pastrami burger. It's actually called the Colossal Burger. We put pastrami on both sides of the beef patty. We also do a pastrami hungry fries, which is chili cheese fries with pastrami and grilled onions on top. We also do pastrami sandwich, of course.
We are looking at a burger, a cheeseburger, single patty with cheese on both sides, sandwiched by pastrami on both sides, on a sesame bun. The fries are your classic chili fries, smothered in cheese. And just to make it even more interesting, sliced pastrami, hot, all over the top of it.
Pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I want a jalapeno on mine.
Hi there.
Hey, can I help you?
A pastrami sandwich, please.
A pastrami sandwich by yourself with a combo.
We just pulled up to Jim's. The amazing thing about this one, besides like the architecturally significant marquee, which I think if it's not like part of the LA Conservancy, it should be, you have a drive-thru. I mean, I don't know anywhere else in the country, maybe even the world, where you can get pastrami in a drive-thru. What does the combo come with?
Chili cheese slice and a drink.
I think we're gonna do just the sandwich.
One salmon sandwich by yourself, okay? It will be $7.36.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, they've given us a wad of napkins,
which will
probably come in handy.
Yes.
All right, so we got like a looks like a burrito wrapped up here, very expert rolling happening with the paper, parchment paper, double layers of parchment, pastrami on a French roll, stuffed pickles on the sandwich with mustard. Again, this like classic trifecta, pastrami, bread, pickles. The trifecta of mustard, pastrami, and bread has been augmented by pickles, not only on the side, but inside the burger.
Correct.
And that seems to be the Boyle Heights version of pastrami's. This does look like a more moist pastrami than Tom's. It's a little tighter of a sandwich, smaller, like it fits into the palm of your hand. I think I might die if I have a bite of it.
Ready?
All right, oh my God. This is more like corned beef to me, like more mild version of pastrami. Thinly sliced, sweet almost.
Mm-hmm.
Fatty, tender, almost melting in your mouth pastrami. But what I really need is a seltzer.
So the experience of eating one of these kind of sandwiches contrasted with the classic Jewish presentation. How do you feel about it? Do you yearn, do you have cravings for this type of pastrami sandwich as a young Jewish woman?
I would say I do not have cravings for the pastrami that I had in most of these places because I am more of a traditionalist, so I like a place that does their meat from scratch. Most of these pastrami places all over Los Angeles, including many of our favorite delis, including Langer's even, they all source from the same wholesaler who makes the pastrami for them, who brines and smokes it. It's a very intensive process that not many restaurants can do. Wexler's does it on their own. I believe that Oinkster does it on their own. But very few places do it on their own. Langer's has their own spice mix, and many restaurants have their own particular variations that they request the wholesaler to do. And you'll see this in cities across North America. I'm not craving the more commercial version, which is what you're seeing in a lot of these roadside stands. But I will say that at Dino's Burgers, we had the pastrami burger and pastrami fries. Those were really delicious. It was the classic LA burger, or cheeseburger, actually. And in addition to lettuce and tomatoes and pickles, there was slices of pastrami around the burger. So it's kind of like a topping. Instead of like caramelized onions, we had slices of pastrami, and it definitely added something to the burger. The fries were almost like a poutine, if you think about it. They were fries with chili sauce, cheese, and slices of pastrami on top. I'm not even a huge poutine girl, but those fries were pretty great to have all that on top. I don't know if I could eat that every day of my life, but in and of itself, it was delicious. If I were craving a pastrami sandwich, would I go and have a pastrami burger? No, probably not.
So tell me about the similarities between carne asada and pastrami.
You know, there's this theory that Mexican pastrami, what we're calling Mexican pastrami, originated in Boyle Heights, and it's sort of one of LA's first fusion foods because you had Jewish immigrants and you had Mexican immigrants living in the same area in Boyle Heights at the turn of the 20th century. So there's this idea that maybe carne asada, which is also in some cases a brined meat, a cured meat, a marinated skirt steak, that is also sometimes served steamed, and that it has the spices that Jewish immigrants might have used in their pastrami. So there's this idea that maybe the reason that pastrami migrated onto Mexican taco stand menu fare is because of the similarity to carne asada or other Mexican spiced meats. I don't know, because some of these taco stands and burger shacks, many of them are not run by Mexican immigrants. They're run by Greek immigrants and many other kinds of people that have come to LA. So I don't know that pastrami has become an iconic item on restaurant marquees and taco stand marquees and burger shack marquees across Los Angeles because of any similarity to Mexican cuisine. I think it has more to do with for some reason, pastrami taking a hold of this city and it becoming, ironically, a slow food that can be eaten very fast at a roadside stand.
You know, the fact that Greek immigrants are the owners of some of these stands leaves me to think that there is a hole in the market for pastrami souvlakia. And somebody needs to investigate that immediately.
The pastrami possibilities are endless.
Find a map of Lara and Abby's pastrami sandwich crawl on the Good Food blog. I don't know how they did that. Next, celebrity chef Padma Lakshmi tells us which sandwich meat changed her life forever. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
The first sandwich I ever made for myself, and probably ate, is a very pedestrian sandwich of sliced white bread with ketchup and thick fat slices of Philadelphia cream cheese smushed together.
That's TV host and chef Padma Lakshmi talking about the first sandwich she ever made. But it was bologna that changed her life forever.
It kind of had the smell and the dark, mysterious funk of meat. You know, if you've never had flesh before, that first bite of another living thing's flesh is quite extraordinary, especially if you're a child. And, you know, it is literally akin to, you know, taking a bite of that forbidden apple. And so that bologna, for me, was what the apple was to Eve, I guess. And, you know, it was opening up a world that rid me of my culinary innocence, but also, you know, that meant I couldn't go back to that pure place. So bologna has a very, very odd, important meaning to my own culinary evolution.
Padma Lakshmi, as we speak, is hosting a competition to build the world's tallest sandwich at Madison Square Park in New York. We can't wait to see the winner. We started off our sandwich show with bread. Now we're going to close it out with some less conventional but equally delicious purveyors of sandwich fillings. We're talking toast, steamed bao buns, brioche buns, and yes, biscuits. Here's LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold with the scoop. He's hanging this week at the Everson Royce Bar in downtown LA.
My favorite thing at the Everson Royce Bar, and often the main reason I go there over and over, is for their biscuits.
Which is something that you would just never say, let's meet at the bar for a biscuit.
They're from Nancy Silverton's recipe. It involves A, sort of an extended resting period, but B, a lot of folding.
So it's one of those mille-feuille, multi-layered things.
It's so multi-layered. I mean, I have it, like, measured out almost to an art form, right? I can get, like, five different
pulls,
and they're all good. And there's that center one that's, like, just a little bit rubbery, and there's the ones at the edges that are super crisp, and there's ones that are a little bit in that are crisp around the edges. It's like figuring out what part of the roast beef you like. And they serve it with a soft butter that's flavored with maple. The reason that the biscuit is so relevant is that the bar has an extraordinarily good bourbon selection. And as it turns out, there's nothing that goes better with a beautiful bourbon than a beautiful biscuit.
There you go. Is there any kind of cured meat that comes along with the biscuit?
The biscuit stands alone. But there are a lot of other things to get there. There's a good version of fettunta. I know we talk about fettunta on this show way too often, and we know it's a fancy word for
Toast.
But it's good toast, and it comes with slices of San Daniele prosciutto.
Yum.
Do you want a Negroni with that, or do you want to stick with the bourbon? Maybe stick with the bourbon. There's bao steamed buns that have, like, crisp roast pork belly in it and a little smear of hoisin, barbecue chicken thighs that are so insanely good. And it's one of those things you don't know why, right? I mean, we all cook chicken thighs. Boneless chicken thighs are like everybody's.
Ubiquitous.
Yeah. We have 20 minutes to cook dinner kind of thing. But his are marinated in citrus and a little bit of Peruvian pepper, I think. There's a lot of herbs, and they're cooked in a way that makes them like super crisp and super tart and spicy. And there's a shrimp roll, which is, you know, some shrimp on a bun, but there's like dill and chive and minced celery, and it's a really good shrimp sandwich. The burger is like maybe the platonic version of what, say, a McDonald's burger would be. It's on a brioche bun. There's aged prime chuck, a little bit of cheddar, some pickles. Not too much, not too fancy. It's just a solid burger. It is almost like snack bar food, right? It's like it's not that different from what you would get, you know, a place at the beach, except it's better.
It's the perfect kind of food to fuel an evening of convivial drinking.
It is.
It kind of has the feeling of somebody's backyard that's just really big with a lot of tables.
Yeah. There's an area where people are playing bocce ball really badly, I might say.
Maybe they had too much to drink.
Yeah, maybe. When people start like throwing their bocce balls as if they're Clayton Kershaw, you know they've perhaps been overserved.
Who's that?
Who's what?
Clayton Kershaw.
You're kidding me.
No.
Do you know who Sandy Koufax is?
Yes.
Okay. He's that now.
Oh, I don't. That's you'll be cutting this out.
No, I know. He's like, he's been the best player on the Dodgers for like 5 years. It's
I'm
okay.
Sorry. I'm not a sporty person. Jonathan Golds is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. He's been talking about the Everson Royce Bar downtown. It's clearly time for somebody, Jonathan, to invite me to a game. Text the words good food to 69866 to get more weekly restaurant recommendations. I hope you've enjoyed this week's sandwich show. If you missed it, you can listen to any of the segments in the show at kcrw.com or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to all of the members of the Good Food team. That's
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia, Joseph
Stone. Hey, Abby, here's mine.
Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
And of course, I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.